Our lesson topic for tonight is when I give glory to God. Now, if you've already looked through the lesson, the question should be pretty easy. If not, I think you can still figure out what we hope for as far as an answer. What does he mean? He says, when I give glory to God. If you use that title, what do you think you'd be discussing? When I give glory to God. Okay, praise, honor, appreciation, those things would come to mind. See?
Tied in with that is you're not taking the credit for yourself.
Yes. When we have certain things happen in life, appreciation is probably going to be directed in some way. We might appreciate a group, an organization, a school. We might appreciate a family member, or we might appreciate God, express our gratitude towards Him, or who else might we appreciate? My abilities, my power, my strength, all the things that I can do, all the things that I can buy. So this is really a contrast between, when you look at some of the scriptures that he gives, it's a contrast between doing what's right, that's honoring God, and praising ourselves for our own accomplishments, abilities, whatever that might be. There is something that isn't really developed in this lesson, which I think would have been a good addition. If you have people who, put it in a different form. Do you have some people who really don't acknowledge anybody when it comes to praise and thankfulness? Yeah. Paul talked about that in Romans chapter 1, didn't he? He talked about the people who are thankless. Now, they may think in terms of their own lives and own selves a little bit, but you do have some people who go through life and they just sort of assume some things. But people, especially Christians, should be mindful that when things happen, things that are good, we should be honoring God, glorifying God. And how about when there are some bad things that happen? Might we still honor and glorify God during those times?
Yes.
Yeah. Teresa and I, a couple weeks ago, we were headed home, and it was kind of late. It was probably about 9:30. I had some people behind me. I was driving. I had some people to the right, and I had a concrete barrier to the left. There was really nowhere to go. And all of a sudden, bang, there's a deer carcass. Well, okay. We couldn't exactly stop on a dime, so I tried to connect with that, as anybody would, in a way where it minimized the contact. Well, Teresa said, I don't want to smell blood and guts for the next several days, so let's find a car wash. Well, by the time we found a car wash, all the undercarriage washes, you know, the automatic car washes, were closed up for the day, so you're under there to the best of your ability trying to spray stuff down, and then you wonder, too, because that vehicle happens to sit very low on the ground. Did we destroy anything or damage anything? So we got it up on a rack the next day and had things checked out. And thankfully, aside from a few deer hair, we were in good shape. But, you know, when we did that, one of the things that we discussed was we're glad that it wasn't something worse. I mean, we could have actually connected with the deer, or there could have been some other things which were a real catastrophe. We could have caused an accident or some other things. So when we think about appreciation, it's not just for good stuff. Sometimes we need to be grateful that things were not worse than they were. You know, we may have gotten hurt, or a child may have gotten hurt, but at least there wasn't a death or anything like that. So, an important lesson as we think about the Christian life. Sure.
If you could comment on something like that. People that went to the doctor and found out that they had some kind of sickness, which was a good thing that they went to the doctor because the doctor found something much serious.
Yes. And that has happened with a lot of people. Sometimes it's correctable, sometimes not, but the doc says it's a good thing that you came in at this particular time. Otherwise, this would have migrated into something else and it would have been a lot worse. So yes, so we do have those times where we may not like the news, but still, compared to what it could have been, thank you, God, that it's not what it might have been. Okay, let's pick up a couple passages here, pulling from Matthew chapter 6, verse 13, and then from 1 Timothy chapter 6, verse 7, and we'll also pull from Luke chapter 12. So let's head somebody over to Matthew 6, verse 13. Sherman will take care of that in just a moment. We'll follow that with 1 Timothy chapter 6, verse 7, Dolores. And after that, we'll look at Luke chapter 12. We'll start with Luke 12, verse 15. Who wants to be on deck for that one? All right, Julie, thank you. Luke 12, verse 15. And then we'll ask you to also read after that verses 17, 18, and 19. Let's start with Sherman. Matthew chapter 6, verse 13.
And do not lead us into temptation, but deliver us from the evil one. For yours is the kingdom and the power and the glory forever. Amen.
Okay, let's fill in our blanks and then talk about this verse for just a second. Lead us not where?
Temptation.
Into temptation, but deliver us from what?
Evil.
For thine is the kingdom, the power, and the glory for how long? Forever. Over the years, I've come across some people. Sometimes it's in a Bible class. Sometimes it is in a personal discussion. But I've asked, some people have asked me, what did Jesus mean in the first part of that, verse 13? He says, and lead us not into temptation. Well, why would the Lord say that? I mean, would God do that? Would he lead us into temptation? No. So why did the Lord make that statement? I puzzled over that for a while. And then one day, it's spelled L-I-T-O-T-E-S. It's a funny grammatical matter, a light at ease that we often don't use. But that's what you have going on here. A person says, don't do me wrong. Don't cheat me. Well, that's true, but what are they really saying when they make that statement? You go and you're dealing, for example, with a pawnbroker, or you're dealing with some other kind of financial transaction where you and the other party are not equal. For example, you're going down to the bank and you're asking for a loan, and you say to the banker, don't beat me up on the interest rate. Well, that's obviously not a literal statement, but what are you saying?
Take it easy, be careful.
Yeah, be careful, take it easy, treat me well, treat me respectfully. All right, so when Jesus, if that's the idea or that's the grammatical tool that he's using here, what's that mean? Don't lead us into temptation is really a way of saying, yes, help lead us into the paths of righteousness. Help us get on the right path. And is God in that business? Absolutely. So you kind of have to look at that statement almost in reverse, and then it makes a great deal of sense. Then the last point there, he says, the important things in our lives relate to our fellowship with God, to whom belong the kingdom and the power and the glory. The important things in life. When you look at someone who's not a member of the church, what are the important things in life to them, generally speaking? All right, possessions will probably take towards the top of the list. The job, that's also going to be something that really matters. All right, family, I mean, for some, even for some Christians, I mean, family takes first priority. What else? The important?
Myself.
Okay, I may help you, but I need to be sure that my needs are met first. So there's going to be that. That's probably one of the best answers that we can come up with. But what else comes to mind?
Money.
All right, possessions. Plus money. You know, you sometimes have an overlap there, but sometimes you find a distinction between those two items. Anything else? That was the other answer I was hoping that somebody would come up with, because their life is so centered in the here and now that even if they have all the money and all the possessions and they're focused on self, if they can't spend the money, if they can't go take the trips that they want to do, be involved with the kinds of activities they want to be involved with, life is not good. But when we think about the Christian, it's not, as Ray said, based on self. It's going to be based on others. Love God, neighbor second, and then, of course, we come in as far as last place. And he mentions here the important things when we think about our life, spiritual things focused on God, and that, of course, is going to help us when it comes to honoring and glorifying God. Anything that you want to add or ask before we pick up with 1 Timothy 6:7? Okay, let's pick up that passage now. Okay, I know when people come into the world, if you look at babies, infants, they're generally not too interested in accepting what basic things? All right, eat and sleep, and if I'm too hot or cold, or I've got a messy diaper, go ahead and change that. So they're pretty well content. But as the years go by, as we all know, what happens to people? We get exposed to the world, and all of a sudden, what do people think they need or want? We want a little more than food, clothing, and shelter, don't we? You've got this, that, and the other thing, and I would like at least that much. If there's a new variety of those items, that would be my preference. But at the end of the day, and we all have been to some funerals, and we've been reminded of this. People have described it in various ways. They said that there is no U-Haul following the hearse and so forth. You can put some things in a person's casket, but still, they are not going to follow the individual. So we come into this world, we leave this world with nothing, and that's why it's important to have the right things in place when we leave this life. And we accomplish that in part by making sure that we glorify God. He mentions, too, some people get carried away with their possessions, thinking that these in abundance are what life is all about. Now, I don't know about you, but a lot of the people that I see as they get older, even if they're not a Christian, possessions seem to become less and less important. You see that sometimes with people downsizing. They would say, well, we can't have this big of a house, and we've got too much to dust and clean, and you know all those kinds of things, so we're going to start getting rid of stuff. And especially if you find someone who enters into a nursing home. I mean, you just can't put it all in the U-Haul and bring it over there to the nursing home. So people have to say, okay, these are my possessions. These are maybe some keepsakes, some memories from way back when that really matter to me, so I'm going to keep a couple of things here. My favorite blanket, you know, maybe there's a trophy or a medal that a vet earned, something like that. But for the most part, the other stuff is going to be sold, dumped, given away, or something like that. And people often, when they get to the later years, recognize this very principle that they are not going to take anything out with them. Thoughts before we pick up with Luke 12? Okay, I also want to get somebody lined up for Luke chapter 16, verse 9. We'll look at that after a bit as well. Somebody want to take care of that in a little bit for us? Brian, thank you. Luke 16, verse 9. But for now, let's start with Luke 12, verse 15.
And he said unto them, take heed, and beware of covetousness, for a man's life consisteth not in the abundance of the things which he possesseth.
Thank you. Let's fill in our blanks and then see if we can explain what Jesus meant. He said, take heed or beware. He said, there's the problem, there's the sin of covetousness. And then he added, he said, a man's life, our existence, does not consist in what? The abundance of the things which we possess. What did he mean by that statement? A man's life doesn't consist of the abundance of the things which he possesses.
Our physical things don't matter.
Okay. We might say, in addition to that, that yeah, self-worth is not based on our wealth. Are there not some really fine people who are really poor? Are there not some really rich people who are really poor when it comes to personal qualities? Absolutely. So Jesus says you can go out there and look at the rich folks, but that is not going to have any bearing on what kind of person they truly are. So we've had some poor people who are rich as far as great personal characteristics and vice versa. So he uses a rich farmer to talk about that in some respects. You have the eye associated with this guy again and again. Let's pick up with verses 17, 18, and 19, Julie, and we'll answer some questions after that.
And he thought within himself, saying, what shall I do? Because I have no room where to bestow my fruits. And he said, this will I do. I will pull down my barn and build greater, and there will I bestow all my fruits and my goods. And I will say to my soul, soul, thou hast much goods laid up for many years. Take thine ease, eat, drink, and be merry.
Okay, three key words there. This fellow said, number one, I'm going to eat. Number two, I'm going to drink. Number three, I'm going to be merry. Let's see if we can take each of those words and apply them to American life. Anybody ever think it's lunchtime, it's supper time, I'm hungry? Let's go out for a bite to eat. Now, 33 may not be the best choice, but there are some other spots. For example, if you were over on Grape Road, you'd probably have some more alternatives, or some of the spots in Michigan that we've gone up to for a hockey game, those kinds of things. But you know, when we think about eating and we drive down that strip, wherever that is, what are we thinking? Oh, hey. We've got all kinds of choices. There's fast food, there's pizza over here, and over here we've got some really healthy stuff, and we've got all kinds of choices. So in that respect, a lot of people can just say, where do we want to eat tonight? We've got 20, 50, 100 different restaurants. So it's not exactly parallel to this fellow, but there are some similarities. And then he says, too, not only do I want to eat and be able to do that, you know, well on a regular basis, but I also want to drink. If you take that and move that into American life, our lives today in this country, do you see anything parallel to that? We've got wide choices, don't we? Looking for a soft drink, you go into the store and you find probably a whole aisle devoted to soft drinks. You can get a name brand soft drink, you can get an off-brand soft drink, low sugar. I mean, it's just option after option after option. And then, what's the third item? I want to eat, I want to drink, and I want to be merry. Once again, if you try to take that word and you put it into American society, does it fit very well? Absolutely. We say we want some amusement. What can we do now? We've had our choice of restaurants. We've had our choice of beverages. Now, what are our entertainment choices?
Anything you want.
Yeah. You know, we can bowl. We can go down and we can play golf inside or outside. We can go down and play paintball. We can have a paint party. the list just goes on and on and on. And anything wrong with recreation?
No.
But if you have a worldly outlook on life, you can see the problem. You just have so many choices, and my life is great without God. But again, you're in a position at that point where you're not trying to honor and glorify God. It's all about me. It's all about my fun, my life. And with the rich fellow, Jesus uses a special word here. God called him a fool and said that if you're not laying up treasure for... All right, self, and that would be the proper treasure, you're not going to be rich towards God. Luke 16, verse 9. Brian, that's you, isn't it?
Yes. And I say unto you, make yourselves friends of the mammon of unrighteousness, that when ye fail, they may receive you into everlasting habitations.
This verse, to me, is one of the more unusual statements that Jesus made. When you think about the word mammon, what are you describing? Money, wealth, possessions. And how's Jesus described the money, wealth, and possessions here? He refers to it, Luke 16:9, as the mammon of unrighteousness. Well, you would think that if something is associated with unrighteousness, it would be a bad thing. Are you still there, Brian?
Yes.
Read it once more.
I say unto you, make to yourselves friends of the mammon
Stop.
Of unrighteousness.
You've got the unrighteous mammon, money, wealth, possessions, and what's Jesus say about it? You make friends with it. Well, that would almost seem contradictory, right? If it's presented in bad terms, why would you want to make friends with it? What was this point in Luke 16, verse 9? Make friends with this stuff that's bad.
So that when it's gone, you have somebody to fall on.
Okay.
Somebody to help you out through the times that it isn't good.
Money is a tool.
Yeah.
And it's often a tool that's used unwisely, badly, poorly by a lot of folks. But Jesus is also making the point here. You know, we would, for example, we could use... almost any tool inappropriately, couldn't we? You know, somebody decides that they're going to take a hatchet and just start chasing people around with it. Well, that's not a good use of the hatchet. But somebody else uses it out there in the woods. They're stranded, and they need to find some smaller wood to light a fire and maybe shave off some wood to get some tinder so they can start that fire. In that case, it's helpful. So as Jesus knew, money is really presented as a neutral thing. Oftentimes, it can be a bad thing, but Jesus said you use that because the time is going to come where it's going to fail, it's not going to be available to you, and certainly everyone else when this world passes away. You use it so that you are rich towards God. If we use the possessions that we have in a good way, do we honor and glorify God?
Yes.
Yes. But if we're hoarding and saying, this is mine, these things are mine, and I'm going to be like that rich farmer, who do we glorify and exalt? Self. So once again, what we have, whether it's a material good or not, we want to do our best to make sure that it's put to good use in God's kingdom and service.
Would it be contradictory? I'm thinking about some verses that Christ was talking about. The tax collector went around and forgave people's debts to make friends so that he would be covered. Now, he gave him praise for that because he was smart doing that. Yet this would almost be like a contradiction.
Well, when you think about that story, you have there the emphasis on forgiveness.
Right.
You have the one fellow who was forgiven a multi-million-dollar debt, and the other guy is, let's just say, for a round number, he's forgiven $100. And the guy that's forgiven the multi-million-dollar debt, again, he's in good shape. The fellow who was owed the $100, he goes and grabs a servant and shakes him up and basically says, you're going to go to prison until you pay what you owe. So the emphasis there would be on, I think, forgiveness. As far as a secondary point, what you were making, I would think that if you are trying to live the Christian life, you're naturally going to make some friends.
Sure.
If you're going to be engaged in what Jesus referred to as the golden rule back there in Matthew 7, if you are, as Paul said in Galatians 6, as we have opportunity, let's work that which is good towards all men, especially the household of faith. If you're interacting with people in that kind of way, you would think that you're going to create some positive relationships. And if you need help, for example, what was the movie? Who was the fellow who was Han Solo in Star Wars? Yes, Harrison Ford, wasn't it? And then, I don't remember how many years back, maybe 10, Ford was in another movie where his wife was killed. He was on the run. Fugitive. All right, I knew some people could help me out. Thank you very much. All right, if you go back, if you saw that movie... Ford is on the run. The doc is fleeing. And at some point, he needs some cash. There was a scene in that movie where you have another doctor, I think it was in a parking garage, and Ford flags him down basically and says, I don't have much time, I need some money. And you know, here's the guy, you know, you can have all I got. Why? Because they were in a good relationship. And I think that would be a good example of what we're talking about as far as the scripture. You know, you've helped me out in ways that I just can't begin to imagine. So if you need a place to stay, if you need some finances, if you need some food, those kinds of things. So as a natural and automatic consequence, not everybody's going to do that. I mean, you can help some people and they'll just stab you in the back. But for people... Yeah. Well, some of those reasons you don't want to take so far, but at least,
no, right. Well,
yeah.
The reason I ask that is that there's a lot of people that are outside of the church that try to bring these contradictions, and that's why I kind of
As a quick follow-up to that, you can have some people who try to butter folks up for some kind of ulterior motive, and that obviously is not right. But you do have that kind of thing. So unless a person is doing that because they're trying to get something from somebody, and people have done that with money. You know, maybe there's a huge inheritance, and a person wants to make sure that they get their cut, or maybe they get more than their cut or get it all. So in the final years, you might have a son or daughter or aunt, uncle, whoever it might be, going in and trying to be on really good terms with this particular friend or relative. So when it's time to probate the will, they're the folks who end up with a pot of cash. So that does happen, as we all know as well.
Part of the term being naive.
Yeah.
That's what we use. Well, they were naive.
Yeah.
Because as you get older, you're supposed to recognize this stuff.
Yeah, well.
But then when you really get older...
Some people get senile.
Yeah. Right.
And, I mean, they just say, well, hey, they were nice to me. They remember that kindness and say, well, okay, let's go ahead and give it all to him or her or help them out. Okay. Sorry. I'm going to turn over there and take a look at it in ESV. ASV says, and I say to you, make to yourselves friends by means of the mammon of unrighteousness, that when it shall fail, they shall receive you into the eternal tabernacle. So it is plural there as well. There are some people who see that verse a little differently as far as the final word or two. Some people think it refers to this life. I'm more inclined, you've got the word eternal there, to believe that that refers more or less to what we have in the afterlife. That that's simply going to be another way of describing what Jesus had in the Sermon on the Mount. Remember he said, lay not up treasure in earth where it's going to decay, but lay up treasure in heaven. So exactly how that all works, I don't know. I don't have a good answer for that because it is a difficult passage as far as the end of it to know exactly what he's talking about. And as I say, some people look at that as far as at least partial fulfillment on the earth, and they would indicate, I think, that people are going to at various times and in various ways on this earth do exactly what W described. They're going to say, hey, will you help me in the past? So that could account for it if you view it in terms of this life. But if you're looking at that from what I think is probably a better perspective, maybe not exclusively, but in heaven, that there's going to be some kind of spiritual benefit there because we've used the money wisely, well, we've helped people, and there would seem to be some aspect, some dimension of a spiritual reward associated with it. But what exactly that is, I don't know.
That's why the eternal or lasting maybe associate that with hell. You associate that with
Yeah, I mean, I don't doubt that there are certain blessings that come to people in this life who are willing to help. But I don't know.
You got Mike talk about there's places set aside in heaven already. He said there was, and there are dwellings that are being waited for to be taken that place.
So,
I mean, I'm just throwing it out there.
Yeah, however that works, I don't know. But it is interesting. Jesus sometimes used words in the plural. For example, it would look strange in the Bible, but there are some places where it talks about the kingdom of heaven. But actually in the Greek text, it's plural. The kingdom of heavens. Which, and I wouldn't, be inclined to think, nor would I teach, that we've got different heavens that people are going to inhabit. Nothing like that. But just to describe maybe the majesty, the glory, the splendor, you do have sometimes verses which use a word in the plural where we would normally associate that with something that's odd, and you do have the same thing here. So again, majesty, the glory of the reward, a very full reward, maybe we could say it that way. That would be how I would look at the verse as far as the primary meaning. Okay, let's see where we left off. Let's pick up with Julie, if we could go back to you, or Brian, either one of you, if you're in Luke chapter 12, verses 17, 18, and 19. Among the other things here, we want to see how many references this fellow makes to himself. This is the rich farmer.
And he thought within himself, saying, "What shall I do, because I have no room for to bestow my fruits?" And he said, "This will I do, I will pull down my barns and build greater, and there will I bestow all my fruits and my goods. And I will say to my soul, soul, thou hast much goods laid up for many years, take thine ease, eat, drink, and be merry."
Okay, how many times do you find the personal pronoun "I" there? All right, that's what I counted too. Six times he uses the PPI, the personal pronoun "I." As you look at the account, this is the other point that the author makes, and it's a good point. There is no attention, as far as the text is concerned, about this fellow helping his fellow neighbors. If Jesus described an actual situation, or if this is a hypothetical, that would be reasonable, and at least I think we'd have to say that maybe it was an actual case. What if you've got all that money? Here's a fella, you know, imagine Donald Trump, for example, just because I think he's familiar to most of us. Let's say that he's got, you know, $5 billion. Well, if he thought, and again, I have no idea about what his thinking is, what he may do. I think he is involved with some charitable work. But what if he thought, hey, I've got $5 billion, and I'm just going to make my life really good? Good choice or bad choice? Bible, when it talks about wealth, it says that we're what? We are? Okay, we're to share, and we're stewards. And being a good steward is going to be part of that sharing. So if you have a person who refuses to do that, what's a problem? That's a problem. Do you not also have an issue if a person looks at their wealth and says, this is because of my power, that my strength, my intellect, those kinds of things? Well, that's also, I mean, the glory at that point is on self instead of God. So with whatever we have, whether it seems to us to be a little or a lot, we do want to make sure that we are good stewards and we don't fall into this trap, because the Lord says the kind of life here is the life of a fool. And the world doesn't see it that way, but God certainly does. Anything before that we go on to King Herod? Stan?
A person can have a dollar, $100, $100 million, et cetera, et cetera, and still be the one talent person if they don't do anything with it. Mm-hmm. That was the issue with that person.
Now, well, Jesus talked about the fella who had the least amount of money. He buries it and comes back with it at the right time. The master is calling for reckoning, and hey, I didn't lose it. I wasn't like these other guys and put it at risk. And the Lord calls him a wicked, slothful. He is an evil servant. So again, we don't have to be a millionaire or a billionaire to do poorly in this area. But we do have some things. We have them for a limited period of time. And, you know, we need to use some wisdom. Some of that needs to be kept. Some of that needs to be spent on ourselves. But at the same time, there are some other people. And what about congregations? You know, we're sitting on some money here, and that's not a bad thing. But do you have congregations sometimes that just decide that they're going to sit on a ton of cash? You know, you can have congregations that just, you know, accumulate and accumulate and accumulate, and they never want to spend a dime. Well, again, there are going to be some people who are responsible for that. So there needs to be a balance there. The Bible does talk about saving, but we also need to make sure that we're just not in this to amass as much money as we possibly can. Focused on not the spiritual, but the secular. And there are some congregations that virtually brag about how much money, you know, we're sitting on, you know, $1 million, $2 million. We don't know what we're going to do with it. But, you know, we've got this much money in the bank. Well, it's almost like the rich fool. You know, we're good for years and years and years. And then they have a missionary coming along. You know, they're sitting on $1 million. And missionary says, look, I need, you know, $4,000 or $5,000 a year. Oh, no, we can't give you any of that. Well, you know, you may want to rethink that.
And that's one of the things I find so contradictory, I guess, about the Catholic Church, is they have all of that money, and yet you have this mentioned, the world needs to help the poor. Mm-hmm. It's like, open your coffers first before you preach to the rest of us.
Yeah. Well, and two, it's interesting, and in my mind, not a good thing, that they offer tax-exempt status for that. Because if you're just raking in the cash and you're buying property and, you know, you're involved with all the gold and the jewels and all those kinds of things, you really don't seem to qualify, at least in my mind, and it's a judgment call, as a tax-exempt organization, because in contrast to what you have compared to what you're doing with helping the poor, you know, you've got a loophole there that you're taking full advantage of. And again, we don't, may not know all the ins and outs, but you would think at the least that they would try to take that tax savings and turn that back into helping the people who need some assistance rather than just filling the coffers fuller and fuller. But
I was raised Catholic, so you have your richer dioceses, what they call them.
Yeah.
You got your not-so-rich, and the not-so-rich seem to be more involved in the community and actually going out to the poor. So not all Catholic organizations don't, and I'm not trying to defend them, but they don't all just sit on their money.
No, that is true. If you look at some of the inner-city groups, for example, the building is not going to be nearly as luxurious as what you would find in an upscale neighborhood, those kinds of things. And they're going to be down there, in many cases, with the people who are involved with drugs and alcohol, other addictions. And, you know, they're really on the front lines of crime and sin in many respects. So, again, you don't want to just, with a broad brush, paint everybody. But you do find some that are in both categories.
Well, sat there and struggled while we have all this money in an account.
Yeah.
And nobody else could really help them because everybody was already tapped out.
Yeah. So again, every congregation is going to have a threshold where they're comfortable saying, we're holding this much money back. You know, maybe for a certain reason, maybe because of size, maybe because of the economy. But you want to make sure that you look at that. And, you know, there's some things that are reasonable, some things that are not.
It goes back to, like I said, good steward.
Yeah. And that's what you want to be.
You
know. Yeah, there's usually no perfect, you know, figure there where you just say this is a magical figure, bang. But, you know, people are cognizant of that. They can use some common sense and hopefully find the right balance, and that's what we want. Okay, let's talk about King Herod for a little bit. This is going to take us over to Acts chapter 12. We'll start with Acts 12, verse 1, and then we'll also pick up verses 22 and 23. Here is a fellow who really failed when it came to glorifying God. And sometimes it happens because a person has a great deal of power and influence, and Herod being recognized as a king, he fell subject to that temptation. Acts 12, verse 1. Is there somebody who wants to read it for us? Acts 12, 1? All right. Dolores, we'll ask you to do that. Thank you.
And about that time, King Herod Agrippa began to persecute some believers in the church.
Okay. Herod stretched forth his hands to do what? Vex, afflict people who were members of the church. Not a good choice. Verse 2, if you read that next, please.
He had the apostle James, John's brother, killed with a sword.
Okay, so you see part of that person persecution illustrated. James, killed with a sword, and then 3?
When he saw that this met with approval among the Jews, he proceeded to seize Peter also. This happened during the festival of unleavened bread.
Okay. I want to stop there for just a second, thinking again about the title, when I give God the glory. If people get away with a certain level, certain degree of something, oftentimes, and it could be a child, but kids and adults, what happens? After they get away with this much, they want more. And if you've ever dealt with a one-year-old, a two-year-old, you know exactly what that's like. They push the envelope this far, and if they can get by with that, lo and behold, it's going to take the next level, and the next level, and the next level. Well, here you have a fellow who's a king. You know, he does something, it's popular, so let's take things a little further. So we've got a prominent Christian killed, and then let's pick up with verse 4, and then after that we'll go through verses 6 to 8. Dolores, if you would.
After arresting him, he put him in prison, handing him over to be guarded by 4 squads of 4 soldiers each.
Okay, so James has been killed, but now he's moving up the ladder a little bit. Who does he target next? Let's go after Peter. So the first step, first stage with Peter is to get him locked up. And that didn't work out too well for Herod, as we see from verses 6 through 8. Let's read those as well, if you would, Dolores, please. Okay, if you are the king and things seem to be going fine for you, getting a little deeper and deeper into the situation, but now you've got a prisoner escape, I think you should probably step back a little bit and pause. I mean, you've got the guy guarded in the way that's described, and that would seem to be pretty much an escape-proof situation. But that's not what happens. As the story continues, let's move down to verses 22 and 23. Uh-huh.
They shouted, "This is the voice of a God, not of a man." Immediately, because Herod did not give praise to God, an angel of the Lord struck him down, and he was eaten by worms and died.
Okay. As the text continues, you've got Herod making a speech, and again, speeches are not inherently bad, but in this particular case, what kind of praise did he get from the speech?
The
voice of a God. Now, there are compliments and there are compliments. I don't know if you've ever given any kind of talk or any kind of speech, but I doubt that even if you got some really good praise, people didn't say, "You have the voice of a God." But that is what they said. And at that point, what should Herod have done? He already maybe had in his mind a little bit of a warning. How did Peter get out? You know, maybe there's something associated with God that's going on here, but that didn't deter him. So, what does he do? He didn't choose to say, like Paul and Barnabas, remember they tore their clothes, you know, when the people said, "The gods have come down to us." No, 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 no. That's not true. Don't think that. You know, God don't strike us dead. We're men just like you are. Herod didn't do that. No, no, I'm not someone who has the voice of a God. He accepts that, and because he was willing to accept that, what happened? All right, there's an angel that shows up, kills him, and then we get to the gross part of what occurred, and what was that? Eating the worms. I don't know if that was a visual illustration of the people or not, but if it was, that really had to be somewhat creepy. And the Bible says he gave up the ghost. So here you have a fellow, he should have given God the glory, he should have humbled himself, and you know, maybe that wouldn't have stopped the people, but at least he could have made it clear that this is not something I'm going to accept. Preachers can fall into this problem, as can just about anybody else. But if you have, and I'm not saying if you find a sermon helpful, just keep your mouth shut. Feedback is always appreciated. But if you are in a congregation and you really like the preacher, and every time he preaches or there's a Bible class, "Hey, you're a great preacher. You're the best preacher we've ever had. Nobody preaches a Bible like you." You know, those kinds of things. "You're probably about as good as Jesus was." You know, those kinds of things. What are you going to do to that preacher? To the point where there's probably going to be some problem with pride in his life. Do you think that parents can do that to kids? The same thing. Yes. "You're the smartest, you're the best, you're the greatest, you never create any problems for me, blah, 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 blah." Well, if a parent does that to a child to give that child you know, positive feelings, you know, feeling good about the self and so forth, build up the self-esteem, when that child hits the age of 18 or 20, what's he or she going to be thinking? "The world owes me this, that, and the other thing because I am almost like God." Well, when the child goes out and sees that he's not or she's not on top of the world, it's going to be a rude wake-up call. So it's good to praise people at times. It's good. It gets back to that balance that we talked about earlier. But we can put people in positions where we cause them to be puffed up with pride. And remember back there in the book of Proverbs, you know, there are some things that the Lord hates. There are some abominations. Haughty eyes, remember that, a reference to pride? So that is something that we do want to avoid, and the Bible gives us some examples, such as here in Acts chapter 12, that tells us that we do not want to be involved with that kind of thing. Anything that you want to add or ask? Okay. Not a good place to break. About 3 minutes left, and a lot of verses about the scribes and Pharisees. But at least, let's introduce this. He says the scribes were copiers of the law, and also of legal documents. One might say that if we compare them to today's world, they were like attorneys, at least in many respects. The Pharisees were a prominent and powerful sect of the Jews. In the days of Jesus and his apostles, they did not need to get attention by the things they were doing, for the nature of their work demanded attention and respect when properly done. Yet Jesus, as we look at his life, some of the strongest rebukes that he pronounced were against the people who were called, what? Seven times. They were called hypocrites. And then you also have the second answer. He called them what in verse 24? Fools. And then what kind of, I had the word guides there, but what kind of guides in verse 28? Blind guides, who were full of hypocrisy, iniquity. And then in verse 33, he said they were serpents, as well as a generation of vipers. When people engage in hypocrisy, once again, kind of we'll save the other verses for next time. But when people engage in hypocrisy, who are they trying to exalt?
Who are they trying to what?
Who are they trying to build up, exalt, make
themselves?
All right. You know, and why would I would agree with that answer, but why is that answer right? Hypocrisy. People are trying to build themselves up. Well, what is hypocrisy? All right. Doing one thing, but you're really another person, if you will. You're acting. Or you're saying one thing, and that's not really what you mean. I just love you so much. Well, I just can't wait to kill you. I mean, that's hypocrisy. Those kinds of things. And, you know, again, that's making yourself look good. It's lifting up the individual versus God. But we want to, if we're going to honor God, then we can do that, at least in part, by being honest about who we are. That things are not always great, or this, that, or the other. Final thoughts that you want to add or ask before we shut it down tonight? Okay, if you mark that spot, we will pick up there, Lord willing, next week.